Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, let's do this. 720 WGN. Hi, Kelly Pope. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
My name is Mark Carmen.
My name is Kelly Pope.
It's the first time we've ever done a show together. I'm saying this is going to be the best show in the history of WGN. On August, what's the date today? August the 18th, that goes into the 19th. It's the 19th? Okay, August 19th, into August 20th.
That's right.
Best show in the history of the station.
All right.
Right here. Good to see you.
You too.
So I'm learning a lot about you here, Kelly Pope. You have like the coolest job I've ever seen. You came up with all the Queen's horses, this amazing story, tragic story of somebody stealing 50 some odd million dollars, and you turned it into a movie. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Where did the impetus to do that come from? How did you get that thought in your head?
Well,
why didn't I get that thought in my head? That's awesome.
Well, I teach accounting at DePaul University, and for some odd reason, students don't always find accounting classes to be fun. I don't know why, but
I loved accounting. Took it at the University of Iowa.
You loved it?
No, I did not. But it was actually the one time in my college career that I really wanted to do well on a test, and it was freaking out, and I called up my dad, who was an accountant, and I said, "Dad, I'm going to fail this test." He's like, "I'm on my way." Dude drove 4 hours to Iowa City to help me study for the accounting test, one of the great moves in Papa Fred history, and I still blew the test.
Oh.
But the effort, I'm proud of the effort, Kelly. Anyway, continue on.
So I use a lot of film clips and TV in my accounting classes because, believe it or not, accounting is everywhere. It's all over the movies, all in the movies all the time.
Okay.
And I just had this idea like, this is an interesting story going on in Dixon. This could make for a great film. So a group of us started going back and forth to Dixon and doing these on-camera interviews with people. And finally, we had enough to turn it into a documentary.
Did you ever interview the actual perpetrator of the crime?
We did not, because the documentary is about the fraud. And
yeah.
It's not, and it's more about who discovered the fraud than the person that committed the fraud.
Okay.
So take a different twist on it. And I didn't want to do a project that would need her, and then I couldn't get her and I couldn't finish
it. Yeah, it makes sense. Rita Crundwell.
And she probably doesn't like me that much.
Nah,
she might be listening, though.
Really?
She's in Peoria in prison, so they have radios.
Do they?
Yeah.
For real?
And TVs.
Is that true?
Yeah.
You can hang out in your cell and just chill and listen to WGN? I don't know. I don't know if I believe you, Kelly Pope.
On Orange is the New Black, they watch TV.
Okay. So, that's true. I mean,
there's a room.
There's always been a TV. I just don't know.
It's a TV room.
Yeah. I mean, I'm okay, you know, late at night, little company. If that's possible, I wouldn't hate it. She stole $53 million of public funds over 20 years. And then she basically, going through your film, she had quarter horses. She had racing horses. She had also, I saw her with one little clip that I saw. I thought it was a racing horse. Maybe I missed it. Anyway, that's just crazy to me.
Yeah. She was one of the number one quarter horse breeders in the world. And
what a wild story. Dixon, Illinois, too, is not too far from here. I mean, I started my radio career in DeKalb, Illinois.
It's very close there. So you might have met Rita one day.
I might have met Rita at one of the city council meetings.
You might have.
When I was the news director, even though I didn't know a whole lot about what was going on. I'll just leave it at that. But what was the fallout from the film? Did you ever hear from her family or anything like that?
I don't think they like me either.
No.
You know, when you make a film about someone's family member and then it ends up on Netflix for a year, and you know, who would have ever thought it would have ended up there?
Yeah.
So they probably thought it would just go away. But we screened at a lot of film festivals. Still get a lot of requests from municipalities and governments all over the country, like, please come show this film and come talk about it so you can scare everybody to death.
Yeah.
So it's been good. I mean, it does a lot of good.
What did it teach you about humanity?
Wow. It taught me that we trust everybody. And we do. You know, and once you like someone, you sort of lower your guard and you trust them. And we all do it. And one of the things I say with the film is we all have a Rita Crenwell in our organization. And that's somebody that you unconditionally trust. And once you become that person, you don't have to follow the same rules. And so that's how she was able to steal the money.
Interesting. $53 million.
That's a lot of money.
On some level, I give her credit. Like, how are you?
She's a gangster.
Yeah. How are you that creative?
Well, she really wasn't. It was a very simple scheme, but no one was looking.
What was the scheme?
She just moved money from one account to the next. So she set up this secret account and just moved money from the legitimate accounts within the city of Dixon to this secret account because she had the control over everything.
But wouldn't somebody ask what's going on with the money in our legit?
One would think, but no.
But nobody's paying attention to what's going on in the accounts. No one's. Right. Was she the only one getting the papers?
She was controlling everything.
Right.
And oftentimes that happens. The person that controls the money, you trust them, and you don't want to hear about it. You only want to hear about it if it's bad news, right?
Yeah. Wow. So, unbelievable. All right, we're going to come on back here and bring in our first guest of the night. And that, why don't you tell us about our first guest?
So Brian Smith is a Chicago Magazine reporter. And I actually met him because he wrote this incredible story about the Dixon fraud years ago. And I reached out to him and interviewed him for my documentary. And Brian has a new book out called The Breakaway. And I wanted him to talk about it. So Brian and I go way back.
Okay. And what's The Breakaway about?
The Breakaway is about the Blackhawks and the Wirtz family. Yeah. So
it's a deep dive into the entire history of the Blackhawks and more specifically the Wirtz family.
Yeah.
Super interesting.
And there might be some crime mixed in there too. So he's going to talk about that too.
All right, cool. Brian's coming up next. Hey, tonight the Sox, I shouldn't read that one because that already happened. Good work by the White Sox tonight beating Minnesota. Get real in the morning. How about we'll do that with Larry Potash, Robin Baumgarten, Paul Conrad, and the entire WGN-TV morning news team weekdays 4 until 10. Kelly Pope is in. My name is Mark Harmon. We're with you till 1 o'clock on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hope you had a great day. Getting ready for a big Tuesday. Mark Harmon and Kelly Pope with you. First guest of the night is Brian Smith. Kelly, this is a good friend of yours. Why don't you introduce our guest?
I will. So Brian Smith is a senior writer at Chicago Magazine and a contributing editor for Men's Health. So the next time you read Men's Health, think about Brian.
Took my vitamins today.
Yeah, and he is the author of The Breakaway. So, Brian, are you with us?
I am. Glad to be here.
Long time no talk.
Yes, it's been a while. I think the last time we talked, it was about the story I wrote about the woman who stole $56 million from that little town of Dixon in Illinois.
That's right. And the last time I saw you was at the screening at the Gene Siskel Film Center. So remember that?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. That's right.
Yeah. So you've been busy since then. You have a book out now.
I do. I have a book out and lots of magazine stories still happening. And keeping busy.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about where did this come from? Where did this idea for The Breakaway come from? Because I remember when we met, I asked you, are you going to ever write a book? And I think you said, I don't know. And so now there's this book. I remember asking you that specifically.
Yeah, well, now that it's over, I think my hesitancy was justified. No, actually, it was a great experience. And yeah, I had written a story. The book is about Rocky Wirtz and the turnaround of the Chicago Blackhawks, and also about the Wirtz family, sort of how the fortune was built and their 50 years plus ownership of the Blackhawks, but also the sort of dysfunction of the family. Father and son, Bill Wirtz, who owned the team, and Rocky's clashes. So, the story was inherently fascinating to me. When Bill Wirtz died and Rocky took over the team, the Blackhawks were named by ESPN as the worst team, not just in sports, but not just in hockey and the NHL, but in all of sports, the worst team. And I think Bill Wirtz was named the worst owner. And within a few years, of course, they had won, you know, under Rocky, who took over, they won 3 Stanley Cups. So I wrote a magazine story about the turnaround. And this was actually before they won that first Stanley Cup after Rocky took over. And, you know, I just found the whole family dynamic really fascinating. And I talked to Rocky after each championship and said, you know, should we, are you interested in doing a book? And finally, after the third one, he said yes. And so away we went.
What do you think changed that he opened up to do it, Brian? Because
I'm sorry.
What do you think changed that after your third attempt you opened up to do it? Because it's super vulnerable. I mean, you're talking about
it is.
You know, I loved my dad, but I didn't like him, and you know, that's still alcohol and just a lot of you know, it's tons of different dynamics. People don't necessarily want to expose their family, let alone a family that's as public as this one. So, what do you think changed?
Yeah, I mean, he was brutally honest. Yes, about his relationship with his father, about how he felt about his father, and, you know, about how his father and his brother, Peter, did not want him to have the team to take over the Blackhawks. And, you know, did everything they could, really, to keep that from happening. So, yeah, and Rocky told me about all of that. So, you know, I think after the third championship, you know, it was, you know, I mean, people were calling the team a dynasty. So I think he felt like, you know, that he had really accomplished something. I think part of it was sort of a legacy, I think, you know, that he wanted to, you know, to have the true story told. And, but, you know, what was interesting was when he did agree to do it, he said he will do it on one condition, and that is that it not be some glowing Valentine to the glory that is Rocky Wirtz. He said, you know, he absolutely insisted on, you know, telling the warts and all story.
Now let's hear about some of those warts coming up here. Brian, can you hang on for us?
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to take quick time out. We'll get you checking news, and then Brian will stay with us after 11:30. We'll learn something here, Kelly. This is fertile ground.
Yes, I don't know a lot about hockey.
That's okay. This is, well, it's family dynamics. You got a family over there?
I do.
Yeah, me too. I don't know if I want to put them all in a book, but the Wirtz family did it, so good for them. Good work, great work by Brian. A quick time out, 720 WGN. Spent the news break talking about goat yoga. Kelly's not going to be doing goat yoga anytime soon.
I don't understand it. Are you going to do it?
I just got a little bit curious. I don't know.
What made you curious?
I don't know. They look adorable, these little baby goats.
But they're walking on your back.
Yeah, and your front and some of these.
And their feet are like hoofs. Like, would that feel good?
I don't know. Let's bring back in our guest here, Brian Smith, who's writing, the Breakaway, the inside story of the Wirtz family. Brian, you ever done goat yoga?
I have not. I must confess, and I have never heard of it until this very moment.
It's a real thing, Brian.
It's a movement.
It's a thing. Okay, I'm Googling it. I don't know. You know, who knows? Maybe I'm game.
So, Brian, let's get back to this family, because I don't know a lot about hockey, and I'm still I still feel relatively new to Chicago, so I don't know a lot about the Blackhawks. But this family dynamic seems interesting to me, and that you were able to get a person to open up and talk about the skeletons that never got out of the closet, and now they're getting them out. So how is it like dealing with Rocky?
Yeah, well, as I said, he was so brutally honest about, as you said, about the skeletons. And I think, you know, that's one thing I really tried to do with this book is to make it not a hockey book, and make it, an interesting enough story for anyone to read, even people who aren't sports fans. And, I think the basis of it is this family dynamic. I think Rick Kogan at the Tribune said there's enough family dysfunction in it for a couple of Eugene O'Neill plays. And I think it's true. It's almost Shakespearean, the clash between the father, Bill Wirtz, and Kelly, you said, you're fairly new to Chicago. Almost anyone in Chicago will tell you that when he owned the Blackhawks, he was, I think I said he was named the worst owner in sports. I think it was like the most hated or something like that. I mean, people had a visceral dislike of Bill Wirtz, and mainly because he refused to put the home hockey games on television, and it just drove fans crazy. And he drove the team into the ground and the franchise into the ground. But, he was considering who would get the team, whenever he died, he did not want Rocky to have it. He wanted his other son, Peter, to get it. Peter had been kind of a yes man who worked with the Blackhawks for a number of years. And everyone expected him to take over the team when Bill died. And Rocky, who was, according to the succession plan, legal succession plan, was next in line, and he took it. And that caused a big rift between Rocky and Peter. And even, and before that, when Bill was still alive, doing everything they can, looking for loopholes in the will to see if they could keep Rocky from taking over. And, it was ugly, a lot of the stuff.
So what did Rocky do so differently than his dad did?
Yeah, well, Bill, one of the knocks on Bill, his nickname was Dollar Bill Wirtz, because he, famously refused to pay top dollar for players, and, he was just kind of a penny pincher in a lot of other ways. So when Rocky took over, the first thing he did was put the home games on television. I mean, like every other sports franchise, in the country. So right away he garnered a lot of goodwill from the fans. But Rocky's theory was Bill's mode of operation was almost like you cut your way to profitability. That is, skeleton staff, right? And it just it didn't work. And Rocky's theory was you have to invest. You have to, for instance, Bill thought having a great locker room and a team playing would be spoiling the players. Rocky knew to attract the best players, you have to have, that kind of infrastructure. You have to, to attract the fans, you've got to give them a great experience. So he began investing heavily. And one of the first, and best things he did, I think, was hire John McDonough from the Cubs, who was a sort of marketing wizard, and to run the team. And so Rocky made a huge investment, and it paid off, obviously, handsomely.
So behind every empire, there's often some type of fraud or crime.
Yes.
Is there any crime schemes in this story?
Well, yeah. The saying goes, behind every great fortune is a great crime, there wasn't in this case not a great crime, but that doesn't mean the Rockies' ancestors were had completely clean hands. So, first of all, you know, when I started researching the book, I didn't know whether the Wirtzes were, they're, hugely rich, big real estate holdings, bank holdings, et cetera. And I wondered, were they, is this old money? And it wasn't. The original, the Wirtz came over. Michael Wirtz was a farmer and out in suburban Illinois, came over from Germany and built a farm and started building, started building the family fortune. But it was really Rocky's grandfather, Arthur Wirtz, who is a book in himself, who during the Depression, bought these big arenas for pennies on the dollar. One of the ventures that Arthur became involved with that a lot of people don't know about was he and his partner virtually had a monopoly on prize fighting, on boxing in the 1950s. And I think they controlled something like 95% of the prize fights in the country and all of the television rights. They owned Madison Square Garden. And the feds came down on them and uncovered, mob ties with Arthur's partner, Jimmy Norris, and, violations of antitrust laws, fight fixing, all kinds of untoward things.
I knew it. I just knew it.
So, as a settlement, the pair were forced to sell the other arenas, Madison Square Garden, and sort of get out of the boxing business. But yeah, of course, that was a major part of the empire.
Well, didn't they also capitalize on Prohibition ending,
I think that's right. Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, people who know something about the Wirtzes know that. Yeah, they own the Blackhawks, but the foundation of the fortune is, their liquor wholesaling business and distribution. And so, yeah, way back when, that was another one of Arthur's ventures, was to get the family into the liquor business. And it was shortly after Prohibition. So, they definitely capitalized on that. And now, the liquor side of their business is, I think, one of the probably biggest three in the country.
I just want clarity. I want you to clarify one thing, Brian, with how Rocky got the team. Was he in line because he was the oldest kid? And that,
yes.
That's why. Okay. I just wanted to...
Yeah. Well, what had happened was, and this is, I think behind part of the bitterness, with Rocky's brother. So Arthur Wirtz, Rocky's grandfather, Bill's father, he was this huge, intimidating force of a man who had built the fortune. And, he was an old school guy and he set up this plan of succession where, the oldest son, not daughter, but the oldest son would become the chairman of the entire family empire. So, and that was Rocky. And Rocky knew from the age of 10, I think Arthur sat him down and told him, listen, one day, or Bill actually told him one day, father, you're going to inherit this. So it was kind of set in stone, and yet because Rocky, he had been all but banished from the hockey side of the business, and the reason was he was about the only person, family or otherwise, who would speak up, stand up to Bill Wirtz, to his father, and Bill hated it, and. So, Peter, meanwhile, didn't, Peter sort of went along with the program. So, Bill but really all but in the business side excommunicated Rocky. Rocky took over the liquor part of the business, but at hockey games, Bill would sit at one table with his guests, and Rocky, before the game would be way over in a corner, not welcomed at the table. Rocky was not welcomed at the board meetings, and Bill actually sent a letter to Rocky saying, I think to his kids, saying, don't bother to come for Thanksgiving, and I'll send your present, your Christmas presents in the mail, something like that. I mean,
well, Brian, I'll tell you this.
That's pretty tough stuff,
I love a book about a lot of family drama. It's sort of like reality TV, exactly. Except you're reading it. So
exactly.
I can't exactly. wait to read this.
Yeah, it's like your great documentary, All the Queen's Horses, about Rita Crenwell down in Dixon. I mean, the backdrop was this horse empire that she funded through embezzlement. But you got at the real drama, which was this little clerk in a small town figuring out a way to steal just more than $50 million. I mean, that was the real drama. So,
yeah.
People don't know a lot about horses, but they're fascinated by the story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what?
The family drama definitely was the powerful, the sort of the heart of the book.
So before you go, what's the state of affairs with the brothers now?
Well, they don't talk. They still don't talk. This has been, I don't know what, 11, 12 years, and maybe more. I don't believe, Peter, who, is with the team most of his career, never comes to games. I don't think he came to the parade for the first Stanley Cup. And Rocky and Peter only communicate through lawyers, basically. Even now. And that was part of the family drama, that both Peter and Rocky's other siblings were on one side, sort of against, the Rocky side. So I think the relationship between Rocky's other siblings has improved, but not with Peter.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining and sharing your book. And I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to read it. And I think I'm going to go to a Blackhawks game.
Oh, you know what? You really should. I mean, it's just I'm not, pushing. I have no stake in it, but it's a fun time.
All right.
Yeah, and it's good talking to you again.
You too.
Brian, thanks for jumping on. Enjoy the conversation.
Hey, my pleasure.
All right, Brian.
Yeah, great.
Brian Smith, the book is The Breakaway, the inside story of the Wirtz family. Let's take a quick timeout, 720 WGN. All right, I'm going to be honest. I got the hot cocoa out for this one. I had to go deep tonight. Mark Harmon, Kelly Pope here. Kelly, I want you to explain what we're doing and who we're talking to and why I feel a lot of fear right now that I'm going to disappear too.
So, I was looking on LinkedIn, and there was somebody that posted about this new Facebook Watch true crime docuseries, and I was like, "What? What is this? What could this be? Why don't I know about this?" So I looked it up and watched the first 15 minutes of it, and I was like, I was hooked. And so I reached out to Bobby Cachone, I think is how you say the last name. Definitely know how to say Bobby.
Is that right, Bobby?
Chacon.
And reached out to him and was just amazed. I mean, he's the coolest person that I think I've talked to this year. Retired FBI agent. Bobby, I'm going to just read some of your just amazing. And now it makes me understand why you are not scared to be in the jungle, because you're not scared of anything, right? So you graduated from law school and went directly to the FBI Academy at Quantico. And you were assigned to the New York. He was assigned to the New York office of the FBI, where you worked at the Italian mafia and Jamaican posses. Like, I'd love to hear more about that. You excelled at developing and operating informants, conducting surveillance, wiretaps. You're getting scared yet?
I wouldn't mess with Bobby. That's clear. Go ahead.
I wouldn't mess with Bobby either. But then there's more. Then in 1995, he was selected as a part-time diver, like diving into the ocean diver. Correct?
When I jump into a pool, I plug my nose. Go ahead.
And for 19 years, he would help with the FBI laboratory, and he established the FBI's undercover forensic program. Did you know that they had one?
Nope.
You didn't know
underwater
that.
Forensic program.
Underwater forensic program. And you became a full-time diver. And during this time, you were a diver on the TWA flight. Do you remember that? The TWA flight 800?
I do.
I remember that because I was scared about flying for a really long time because I was young. I remember that. Like, it was yesterday. And you led the dive team on cases such as anthrax searches in Virginia. The space shuttle crash? Really?
Yes, 2003.
Wow. So I'm just going to stop there because when I started reading, I think I sent you a message this afternoon. I said, this is the most intriguing bio that I've ever read. I don't know about you. I didn't ask you your bio. Do you dive?
You talking to me?
Yeah.
I am one of the worst swimmers of all time. No, I do not dive. And yes, I'm super impressed by Bobby, and you've had an incredible life, man, for real. And thanks for joining us on 720 WGN. We appreciate it. And are you in the Amazon right now? Where are you?
No, we're back. Okay. We're long back.
Okay, long back. Okay, so you so we can confirm that you survived.
Yes. Well, I can't confirm my castmates because you have to watch the show for that. But obviously, I made it back.
Oh, don't do that. That's it. Now you know, like someone could have died. So, Bobby, talk to us. How did you even get picked as a cast member for this series?
Well, you know, I did 27 years in the FBI, and I retired in 2014. Then I moved to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, for a couple of years. And when I came back to Los Angeles, which is my home now, I grew up in New York, and I was based in the FBI's office in New York for 15 years. My wife is a producer, and I got hired as a technical advisor on a show called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, which was a spinoff of the now well-known Criminal Minds franchise. Our show had Gary Sinise and Alana De La Garza. So I worked with Gary Sinise on that program for 2 years. We were canceled, and then I went over to the main mothership, the Criminal Minds show. I was on that for a year as a technical advisor. And during that time, I started getting requests to appear on CNN and MSNBC and Fox and other national news outlets, just commenting on FBI business and crime. And it wasn't long before Oxygen and ID started calling me to do on-camera work. And so, you know, I kind of got into that. And my purpose was always to write. And so I was able to write on Criminal Minds a little bit. And I'm currently a staff writer on a new show that'll star Nicole Kidman. So I'm writing that. We're writing that right now. But because of my on-camera work, I guess I did some work for a production company in Australia, and they had a second project coming up, and they had acquired the rights to tell this story about three explorers that went looking for this lost city of gold in deep in the Amazon in the 1980s. These are three explorers on three different expeditions. They did not know each other, three totally separate incidents, and they went off into the jungle looking for this lost city, and they never returned. And it's a fascinating story. There's intrigue, there's mystery, there's everything you can think of with a mystery like this we encountered. And it's in one of the remotest parts of the earth to get to and stuff. And so getting there and conducting the investigation, just getting there was the largest challenge that we had.
Can you talk about what's the oddest thing that's happened to you in the Amazon?
Well, you know, you were dealing with a couple of different things. The threats were both human, animal, and Mother Nature. So torrential rains made the rivers rise quicker than we could deal with it. You know, we had everything from, I saw three wild jaguars one day, tarantulas the size of, basketballs, climbing up trees outside where I was sleeping. We had to sleep often in hammocks that were suspended off the jungle floor between two trees because there were so many critters crawling around and stuff. And, some of the river we were traveling up had illegal gold mines. And so, they warned us, our local guides warned us to keep our cameras down and keep our phones down because the illegal gold miners, they're running these lines along the river, Amazon, and stuff. So the threats were multitudes. And, it was interesting going down there. And we had a good team around us. We had a great crew. And our team of investigators was top notch.
Your phone's breaking up here a little bit. I think we can hang in with it for another moment or two here, or else we'll just reconnect here, Bobby. But did you say you had there were illegal gold mines around you, and you were there was a concern that if your cameras caught them, that people were going to have a real problem with you being there? Is that accurate? Did I hear that right?
Yes, that's correct. So we were warned about that, and not to have our phones out, not to use our cameras at all. In certain stretches of the rivers that we were traveling, and the rivers are really the only way to travel there. So, there were human and animal and nature threats to us during the trip.
So who's living there?
There's natives. We're talking about so deep in the Amazon that some of these tribes have never had outside human contact, right? So, there's generations of tribes that still live down there. We came into villages that, had been probably decades since they last saw an outsider. And then
you show up, and what do they do?
Well, they were, for the most part, they're very welcoming. It's as if you ever come across an indigenous peoples that, they're a little standoffish and stuff, but it all depends on the local guides you have that introduce you and that can explain to them why we're there and things like that, and to put them at ease. Because oftentimes that kind of existence is a survival one, and you're very hesitant to interact with outsiders because most of the time, unfortunately, outsiders mean they want something from you. So we were able to overcome that with the local guides that we had. We were able to, conduct our investigation.
So, Bobby, I can tell you this. I would be absolutely terrified if I was one of the six investigators. Like, I probably would leave. But my favorite character is your tech guy, because I can identify. He seems legitimately scared. Like, when he has the net over his face because he's trying, because of all the mosquitoes and insects, like, I would be him. And so right now, he's my favorite person.
Yeah, that's Brennan. That's Brennan Edwards. He was our tech guy. He's from here in Los Angeles, where I'm from. And he was awesome. When you go into an environment like that, you really, we wanted to, as much as possible, deploy, modern techniques and modern equipment. Because that really enhances your abilities to conduct investigations. And so we brought Brennan, and Brennan was, a godsend to us, being able to deploy this type of technologies. You have to power the technology, you have to make sure the batteries are charged and you have batteries. And it was just a very, very difficult thing to get technology that deep into the jungle. And not only did he do that, but he's an excellent drone pilot. So he was able to put his drones up in the air and further our reach into the jungle, where we can see. He was basically our eyes in the sky, and we were able to see upriver and sometimes into the jungle, thanks to the technology that Brennan brought. But, like you said, he's a city guy, and the jungle was very new to him, and so he had those additional challenges of adapting to an environment that he was not very used to. But he did an awesome job, and he adapted as well as anyone could. And like I said, he was an invaluable member of our team, helping us deploy those electronic tools of his.
How long were you in the jungle?
About 8 weeks.
Oh.
We did the first 3 weeks on the Peru side, because the legend has it, that there are two sister cities, and one is in the Peruvian mountains north of Cusco, Peru, which is basically the jump-off city most people know from Machu Picchu. If you're going to Machu Picchu, you go through Cusco, and that was Acacor. And then Acacor had a sister city, Acaquim, which was on the Brazil side. And so we had to fly over to Brazil and basically go up the Amazon River, up a couple of tributaries, and up the Rio Negro to reach the spot where it was rumored, legend had it, that Acaquim was located. So there were two cities that we were looking for, both of which were part of the same legend, that the explorers who went off into those jungles in the early 1980s went looking for and never returned.
So, Bobby, this is dangerous. What? It sounds highly dangerous. What attracted you to this?
Well, I mean, I'm an investigator by nature, right? I've been, my dad was a New York City police officer. My brother was a New York City police detective. I went into the FBI at the early age of 24. It's been almost 30 years there. So, you know, investigations are in my blood. And when they contacted me about this mystery, about these three people who had gone missing, it really interested me. And the one thing they had in common, well, two things they had in common, they were all going looking for the same lost city of gold. And they all went into the jungle with the same individual. And on each occasion, he came out and they didn't. And so, you know, that naturally sparked my curiosity. I'm a justice seeker. I'm a victims' rights advocate. And so, you know, one of those three was an American from San Francisco. And, you know, I got a chance to speak to his sister, who has lived with her brother's disappearance for her whole life and stuff. And so, you know, that's what attracted me to it, that justice for the people that I thought may have been wronged.
720 WGN, continuing the conversation with Bobby Chacon. The Curse of Acacor. Bobby spent eight weeks in the Amazon jungle, amongst everything else he's done in his life. Mark Harmon, Kelly Pope with you on 720 WGN. Bobby, one thing that you said in our first segment tonight is that because there were tarantulas and God knows what else, you had to suspend a makeshift cot, bed, whatever, between two trees so you could sleep. I personally wouldn't be able to sleep in that situation, Bobby.
I wouldn't be sleeping at all.
Did you?
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, not only you're suspended, but you're zipped in because of the bug. So it's like a big cocoon, and you zip it, and you're suspended from two trees. And, you know, yeah, it was a challenge living there, you know, especially for us city folk. It was a challenge. I've been in extreme environments before, so I'm able to do that. But it's certainly, you know, not where you choose to. You do it because, you know, you have to get the job done in those environments.
The zipping, that might give me a drop of comfort. I'm zipped in. You can't get to me. I'm just going to hang here and take a nap.
You might see something could fall on you still, or something could, like, wrap around your cocoon.
Did that happen?
Well, you know, one of our guys, when, you know, the first thing in the morning when you unzip and you kind of, you're swinging there by the hammock and you're going to put that first foot down on the ground, you better have your boots already on. So it's, you know, you're laying there in this suspended hammock and you're trying to dress yourself and not fall out because you can't put your bare foot on the jungle floor without, you know, seeing what's down there.
Like what? What's down there? Like what?
Usually tarantulas and other spiders and. I have pictures and videos of huge tarantulas that were always around and snakes and other things like that. So, you know, that those are the jungle creatures that, you know, and as soon as the sun goes down, they all come out, right? Because animals in that environment feel safer in the dark. And so, you know, the jungle kind of comes alive at night. So, sleeping was a bit of challenging as well.
Oh, was anybody crying at night? Like, you know how in movies you see people crying in prison, like, when the lights go down? Like, was anyone just like, why am I here? I'm coming.
No, we had a pretty hearty group. One of our teammates, one of my fellow cast members, was Meg Hine, and she's from the UK. and she's Bear Grylls' main safety person. So she climbs and boats. I mean, she does all the safety stuff. She's not afraid of anything. She's always out in the elements, and she was mainly one of our people that kept us safe and got us where we were going. The other female on the team was Karina Oliani from Brazil. She's a medical doctor. She's a wilderness doctor. And she's climbed Mount Everest twice. Last week she got back from climbing K2 in Pakistan. So she is quite the badass, and she was there also to keep us safe. She spoke, obviously she's from Brazil. She speaks Portuguese, English, and Spanish. So she was there to keep us safe and get us where we needed to go safely. And so Martin Pepper, American geologist, was there to interpret our petroglyphs and kind of give us what the symbols meant, you know, on these ancient, you know, ruins that we were able to find and stuff. So he was able to, you know, digest those and translate them. And then finally, my partner, Paul Connolly, who's from Ireland and is an investigative journalist in the UK, and him and I kind of conducted the thrust of the criminal investigation, the murder investigations. And while Meg and Karina and Martin, you know, were doing the Lost City end of the investigation. And so, but we were all together most of the time. There were times we each branched off to do different things. But we were a team of six because Brennan was there with his equipment and stuff. And so it was a fantastic crew. We worked with cameramen and sound guys that were just top notch, because operating in that environment was more than challenging.
Would you do it again?
Absolutely. Oh. I've already told the producers, an Australian production company, I've already told them, look for the next adventure for us. You know, this was just a fascinating thing. It's 12 episodes. Two have already dropped on Facebook Watch, and they're live. The new ones drop every Sunday. Sunday, and then after that, you can watch them at any time on the AquaCore Facebook page. It also has some behind-the-scenes content if you go to the page as well. I mean, this whole thing started in the early 1970s when a guy walked out of the jungle and said, I'm the last remaining descendant of a tribe that lives in this subterranean lost city called AquaCore, and my people have all died, and I'm the only one left. And, you know, that guy was later the subject of a book written by a German journalist called The Chronicle of AquaCore, and that book basically told the story of AquaCore and this guy who walked out of the Brazilian jungle as the prince of that last tribe. And so he tells his story, and people, mainly in Germany and Europe, became fascinated with the book, and some in the U.S., and these three explorers all had read the book and all had went down there and contacted a guy to take them into the jungle to find this lost city.
So a couple things that I have enjoyed about the first two episodes. I love the parallel stories. I love the criminal investigation with the story of the lost city, because I think it gives everybody something, you know? So I love that.
Sure.
And then when I was reading about the show, I read an article that said that Facebook says that there's 720 million people monthly spend at least 1 minute on the video platform Watch. So this whole community has the potential to see it. And I love the interaction of try to solve this case and discussing it with this Facebook community. I think that interactive element is genius, and it just sort of creates this, you know, you're trying to solve it with these people from all over the country. I saw one of the behind the scenes with the investigative journalist, and when I noticed all of the people from all over the world that were joining in, like there were people from South Africa, there were people from Tennessee, I mean, just everywhere trying, just asking questions and wanting to know more. So I love how the writers, producers, directors have done these parallel stories and created this movement of people that are just like in this community. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very unique in that aspect. I mean, you have such access to us, the six investigators that were on the team. I mean, I'm on literally a couple of times a day and in the evening responding to people's questions and comments on the show and things. And so I'm literally daily interacting with fans of the show and people that are watching. They're wondering about things and asking questions. And I'm able to do that because of the platform that it's on. It's unique in that aspect. I literally get messages every day from people saying, hey, I have a question on the show. that I saw on Sunday, or maybe they watched it during the week, and you can you have that almost immediate feedback from somebody that you're watching on a show like this, and that's a really unique aspect of interacting with the people that you're that you're watching.
Well, I can't wait for episode 3 through 12, and I also can't wait. Bobby, I'm going to say it on air. You said you would come to DePaul and present to my students. So is that still going to happen?
Absolutely, sure.
And we're going to watch some of the episodes, and we're going to talk with you live, and you're going to tell us all about your career as a as an agent and this show. So thank you, thank you, thank you for joining us. And wow.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to speaking with you and your class.
Hey, Bobby, before you go, what's your opinion on what's going on between the office of the president and the way the FBI is sort of being portrayed? Does it bother you? What's your reaction?
Sure, of course it bothers me. It's an organization I worked for almost 30 years, and had the finest men and women I've ever had the pleasure of serving with. I'm hoping that, because I just saw this week that we've kind of turned a corner, because it's kind of died down now, if you've noticed. And the FBI just announced that they had a record, almost a record number of job applications. I think we've got 35,000 applications for 900 spots, new agent spots next year.
Wow.
Which is way high. It had actually dipped to a low, as you can imagine, 2 years ago. Last year, it came up a little bit, but because of the constant battering that we were getting, applications had dropped way off. And that news this week that applications were way up again is a hopeful sign to me that maybe we've turned the corner and we can get back on doing the job for the American people. When I applied for the FBI back in 1985, applications were way high, and based on applications and the number of spots available, it was harder to get into the FBI than it was to get into Harvard, just based on a percentage. And so, you know, I want to get back to that where the FBI can select from, you know, a very, very qualified pool of applicants and again, start to restock the special agent and the analyst positions, because you're right, the last couple of years we haven't had a good time of it. And, you know, hopefully I think this is a sign that we've turned a corner and we can get back to doing the work of the American people and focus on what we need to focus on.
Well, I only know you from this interview, Bobby, but I think the FBI did right by hiring you. So thank you for your service.
Thank you, Mark.
And phenomenal job in the jungle. I can't wait to watch more. So that it was great to talk to you tonight, Bobby.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Bobby Chacon, that was awesome. I'm coming to class.
You're coming to class. Okay. He's coming.
Yeah. Kelly Pope, Mark Harmon with you here till 1 o'clock. Kelly and I are headed off to the Amazon after the show.
No, we're not. Absolutely not. Did you hear what he said?
He said that you have to put your boots on before you touch the ground of the Amazon because there might be a snake down there. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't care if my boots are on. There's a snake down there.
Or a tarantula the size of a basketball.
See, my only experience with a tarantula is in the Brady Bunch.
The little one?
Yes.
I remember that episode. I remember seeing that.
That reminds me, I'm supposed to interview the Brady Bunch. I don't even know when that is. It's coming up. I'm talking to Cindy and Bobby.
Oh.
There's something going on. But regardless, that Bobby was fascinating.
Yeah, but you have to watch the show. You have to join the movement.
The movement?
The community.
The community.
Yes, they are. I mean, it's addictive.
How about Facebook Watch?
Facebook Watch?
There is some crazy stuff going on right now. I don't know if Facebook Watch quite falls into it, but like a documentary like that, back in the day, it's not on Facebook Watch. It's on ABC.
I know, but look, streaming services, and it's free. I mean, this is totally free. And now they're making their money through ads, but still.
Right. There's enough money off of Facebook Watch to send that crew down to the Amazon, which is not cheap.
Mm-mm. Because you have 6 investigators. We're not talking about how many camera guys they have,
right.
Sound.
And yeah. how to do it all.
Right. And I mean, I believe that someone is securing the area. There's no way. Right? Like, can't you... needs to be like a SWAT team that goes down there and puts like a fence or some type of barricade around, right? Did you hear him say a jaguar just ran by?
I didn't. Well, judging by the way he described it, I don't think there was this SWAT team that you're...
Well, that's how I'm traveling.
Yeah. I don't think there was a SWAT team called into action. And I imagine, too, I'm going to walk up on these people who haven't seen an outsider in God knows how long, and I've got my cameras, and I'm trying to figure out who died and how they died.
And history doesn't show that that ever works out well. When an outsider comes in and you've never seen them, that they're there for good.
And these people are living, I mean, it's, hey, how are you? You ever heard of Michael Jordan?
No.
I mean.
No.
You got internet around here? I mean, it's amazing, if you think about it, that this is all the same world.
It is.
Right? I mean, we're not traveling back in time.
Or think about this. Like, they have this, one of their cast members is this tech guy. And he has drones flying around. Imagine if you mm-hmm. are in one of these villages where you have very little outside contact. He said decades, right? And you see a drone flying in the air? Like, yeah, what do you think that is?
I have no idea. Right? What the hell is that up there? I'm going to go get my...
Bow and arrow and shoot it down?
Bow and arrow and my rock-slinging object, and I'm going to shoot it down. Did you see the story of the fugitive in Wisconsin that just got found out in a bunker?
No. No. What?
This is a crazy one. So I was talking about this yesterday, but it fits into your interest. Maybe you could do it. This is a guy, he's a terrible person. You know, child molester, all that. But so he gets caught, and he was sleeping in this homemade bunker in Wisconsin for 3 years, and a hiker comes walking in the woods off the Ice Age National Scenic Trail in Ringo, Wisconsin, and he sees like a shelter dug into an embankment. I don't know about you, Kelly, but I see a shelter dug into an embankment.
I'm going the opposite way.
This dude opened up the door, took a little look inside, and he sees this guy, he's sleeping on a cot, he's got tools around him, there's canned food. So he calls 911, and then they find Jeremiah Button, 44. There was a warrant for child sex crimes. He had disappeared in 2016, all right? He, you know, he was going to stand trial. I was like, nah, I'm not going to jail, I'm going to the bunker. And this dude... hold on a second here. I want to tell the story correctly here. He finds this hideout on the Ice Age Trail, 1,000-mile footpath that winds from.
And the guy's by himself.
By himself, okay, right? You don't buy it? Hold on. Listen to this. He digs out the bunker. He lines the wall with cardboard and tarps. He made the roof out of tarps and logs. He starts moving in supplies one backpack at a time. He brings in a half a pallet of canned food. He's telling, after he gets caught, he tells him how he did it. He takes his car, his wallet, and his ID, goes to his mom's house in Richfield, Wisconsin, leaves a note that he says he's headed to Florida. Dude ain't going to Florida, he's going to the bunker. He takes a train to Stevens Point, covers himself in coal. Apparently there's a bunch of coal workers that are on this train, so he disguises himself that way. He gets off in Wausau, Wisconsin, which is, I've been up there. There's a ski resort up there that I did. There's the Great Rib Mountain Inn. Beautiful spot. Love it. But so he gets off in Wausau. He walks 2 days to the bunker. And the bunker is right by this landfill. So he's going over to the landfill to get food, clothes, tools, electronics. He's got a TV antenna on a tree outside the bunker, so he's watching TV. He's got 8 solar panels and car batteries that he's taking from the landfill.
Yeah.
Powering the TV, other electronics. He's got lights, he's got fans. He's got a homemade generator that I don't know how this dude figured out how to do that too. And he lived there for 3 years. 3 years by yourself in a bunker.
He had a radio.
He had a radio. He had to.
He's like Castaway. Tom Hanks on Castaway.
So would you rather in the weird question of the night at 12:47, would you rather be by yourself in that bunker with no contact with anyone, or would you rather be in jail? Because I think I'd rather be in jail by myself in some...
Wait, though. He's a child molester, so he's not going to have a good time in jail.
That's a good point.
He's going to have a tough time in jail.
Fair point.
So I think I'd take the...
The bunker?
The bunker, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because that's a different category.
I mean, I can't relate to either.
No.
And I don't think you can.
No.
But that's and he said to the police, well, it's good to actually have some human contact to be able to talk to someone.
But let's go back to this hiker.
Okay.
So you're hiking by yourself?
Yeah.
That far off a path? Like, who, do you do that?
No.
And you just are so curious.
You're gonna look in.
And you have cell service out there in the middle of, I guess he had an antenna, so maybe that's why he had cell service.
I mean, the only way that I'm opening up that door, if I'm like a conceal and carry tough guy, where I know that I'm not, you can't mess with me. Maybe I would do that. If I was of that mindset. If I was our guest Bobby Chacon, maybe I'd open up that door.
If you were trained to kill.
Mark Harmon right here. I mean I'm sprinting the other way.
Absolutely.
And screaming at whoever brought me out there and said, "What are we doing? We're gonna get killed."
Why was that hiker by himself? Why do people do that? Why do you go out and do things like that alone? Anything can happen. You could fall. I mean, anything. Why do you do that?
It's peaceful. People need some solitude.
Go to a park. Sit on a bench. It's just dangerous. It's just dangerous.
It is. But you know, okay.
Just like the news story about the missing fishermen. Like, at least there was two of them. They were together. We don't know where they are, but they weren't alone. Like, you don't do that. You don't go on a boat by yourself. You go with someone. You don't go on a hike alone. I find it suspicious.
See, but people do that all the time. Can't go on a... What about like a bike ride?
Alone? Off trail? No. Huh. No. No. I don't buy it.
Kelly likes some company.
Yeah! I'm not doing that. It's just too much. It's too dangerous.
Michael Heidemann, you walking on a trail alone, you're kind of a... on your own alone guy.
Grew up in a small farm town. I did that more than 1,000 times by the time I was 21.
Okay, so would you knock on the door of a bunker if you saw this place where it looks like someone could be living, would you open the door?
It's funny you say that, because when I was growing up, we had a hermitage house back in near Wisconsin, the border of Wisconsin, and it was said to be haunted. And I remember my friends and I, we went up there to see who was there for at the time being, and I got stung by a hive of bees. So you never want, it's a long story, let's just say you never want to go up to a hidden bunker and knock on it. That's a bad thing you do.
So wait, hold on a second. Rewind. I sometimes I don't digest things as quickly as others. You lived in some rural town where there was a rumored, did you say haunted house? Did I hear that right?
It was a haunted hermitage house.
What's a hermitage house?
So when there was this place where you would go and reflect, it was kind of like a Christian like resort, I guess.
Okay.
And in the deep woods, they had this single house where you would go and live there for like weeks on end to meditate and stuff. You couldn't bother anybody. And my friends and I... thought it was a good idea to go and knock on the door and just see who was in there.
Are you out of your mind?
Yes. The answer to that question is yes. I'm answering for him.
There's not a lot of stuff to do when you're living in like Woodstock or McHenry, Illinois, on the cornfields.
So you and your buddy knocked on the Hermitage House where mm-hmm. people are meditating and trying to get all zen-like.
That's supposed to be haunted.
Yes.
Right. Let's not leave that out. That's supposed to be. And what happened?
And, we went in, and much like, I don't know, like, have you ever seen the movie My Girl? There was a swarm of bees on the ground, and there was like a hive of bees that we stepped on.
Oh, my goodness.
So it only added insult to injury. We were doing something wrong, and then, of course, you step on bees, and you get stung in the face. So that's why you should go to the bunker.
Was anybody in the house watching you get stung by bees in your face?
Probably.
Probably.
The ghost.
Yeah. The ghost.
Oh, shoot. And so the story continues. But I don't know. I hearing his story about what he needed to go through, I don't know if I can do what Bobby did, yet going to an actual, you know, uncharted area and then live out that life. That's much more different than going in into McHenry, Illinois cornfields.
Yes, that's true. But I'm not going to the McHenry cornfields either, for the record.
No, I'm too scared. I think I'm just gotten old and scared. You know, I'm just too. I couldn't even hardly listen to a story.
Were you rambunctious as a kid?
I'm in Durham, North Carolina. Not really.
Well, hold on a second. Durham, North Carolina. You got a lot of. There's a lot of ground out there. Is there not? That's flat out country.
Not in Durham. In Durham.
You're not too far from country. No? Am I wrong? I mean, yeah. I'm not an expert of the Carolinas.
Yeah, I mean, so you have the Research Triangle Park, you have the Triad. It's not as rural as you think. In central North Carolina. Go on the outskirts, yeah, but I never went there.
Okay. I mean, I went to some weird resort in Virginia one time, and then somehow we...
Massanutten?
I don't remember the name. But there was hot springs over there. And we came up on some house where my buddy's like, let's go in the hot spring. And we walked in there and opened up the door. And there was about 8 dudes in there in this hot spring, which doesn't bubble. And they're all sitting there not wearing any clothes. And most of them don't have any teeth. And I'm like, I got to get out of here because we're not going to make it home.
That's not Durham, North Carolina.
It wasn't Durham,
North Carolina. Do you know that Durham, North Carolina was voted as the 4th most educated city in America?
Well, you got Duke University.
Well. You know, yeah.
I mean, I couldn't believe the money driving around that campus.
Oh, yeah.
Those buildings were, it was like dollar bills were falling off of them.
The trees were made with a set of leaves that had dollars on them.
I mean, y'all aren't playing over there. All right, let's take a quick time out. We'll wrap it up next, 720 WGN.